This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Just kidding. Welcome to Discovery 1, Lecture 1. Now, before we get started on the actual lecture itself, I'd like to congratulate everybody for rocking up tonight. We have an incredible turnout. I think we've got 20 users connected to the Ventrilo server. And we know that there are people who will have to leave early and stuff. That's fine. We understand that. And thank you for letting us know. But just sign out. It's okay. We won't take it personally. But we would ask you to please look at the recordings and listen to the bit that you missed. Like, download the recordings once they go up on the website and listen to the pieces that you missed. Now, what we're going to do is I'm going to hand over to Grace, who's going to talk briefly about the scavenger hunt and stuff, and then we're going to handle any questions that you guys might have burning away before we actually start on the lecture per se. So I'll just chuck it across to Grace. And hers is not working, so she'll just be fixing her Ventrilo. Are you even in the lecture theatre, Grace? Okay, technical problem. So I'll just fill, as most good people do. Ah, there's Scott, and he'll be in a moment. Now, does anybody have any questions they would like answered before we get started, before Grace re-logs in and talks to you all about the scavenger hunt? Any pending questions?
Here we are. That's much better. Now I actually have a working hotkey.
Don't burn yourself on it, though.
Okay, yeah, probably. You know all this. For the skills assessment, guys, don't worry about the questions you got wrong. It's okay. Especially the visual ones. We'll talk a little bit about that in ITE1, and we'll make sure that the visual questions get plenty of going over, and that you know what your screen in Windows looks like, and all the hand tools. We'll talk about all that. Any questions on the skills assessment? Okay, that's a no.
Just before Grace continues, I'd really encourage people, if you do have a question, we're not going to think you're silly if you ask a stupid question. We're going to think you're silly if you don't ask your question, because we've honestly had cases where 6 weeks in, people have not felt comfortable asking a question. I mean, if there's a question you really don't want to talk about in front of the group, Skype us up after lecture, or Skype us up when we're in at the association, and we'll be more than happy to answer it on a one-to-one basis. But we are not going to laugh and point, partially because you're halfway across the other side of the world, but mostly because we're not that sort of people. We will certainly help you with whatever questions you may have. I have fielded a couple of questions before lectures, and if you generally don't have any, that's good. But if something does confuse you or whatever, please key your name into chat and we will handle your question as soon as we can. If the question turns out to be too complex to answer on lecture, we will field you off to Skype later on, but we are more than happy to answer any questions you might have. Back to you, Grace.
Okay, the scavenger hunt. That's just a little exercise to make sure you know the website. Please, you guys, I've noticed everybody's done really well, except for spell checking. Please spell check your work. It's really good. It makes reading it a lot faster, and I don't have to go back and say, What did they say? Oh, okay, yeah, that. So it really does help. That's step 11, and there actually is a spelling error in there that I left for you guys to find and fix. And, yeah. So there you go.
There's actually 2 spelling errors. One of them I fixed before she let the worksheet go. Yeah, and then there was one she intended to leave in there. So basically, the reason we want you to spell check is because if your spelling errors aren't... somebody's keyed up.
Not me.
Yes, you're
right. Am I? Oh, weird. Okay, hold on. Am I still keyed up?
Yes, you are.
My apologies for being late.
No worries. Okay. So, we'd really like to see everybody who's in the Discovery class rip through, and everybody who's in ITE's, Grace's ITE class, we'd all like to see you do the scavenger hunt. If you really think that the scavenger hunt is beneath you, then you get to call us up on Skype. We'll ask you 3 random questions, and if you don't get those questions right, you get to go and do the scavenger hunt. So, that's how that works. We're sorry that we had to put the scavenger hunt out there, but we are having real problems with people sitting down and reading the student resources page. We'd all like you to read it once. We don't expect you to be able to recite it or anything like that, but it is very important to at least see that student resources once, because it is your lifeline to these courses. And yes, you're going to hear us say that for the next 3 weeks. Sadly, it's true. We generally believe in that philosophy. Okay, do you have anything to talk to them about while I spend 5 seconds killing the radio?
Okay,
The first thing I'm going to do is move my microphone into a good spot. There we are. Okay, the second thing I'm going to do is briefly cover, just very quickly, what this course is all about, what you're likely to get out of this course, and what you're likely not to get out of this course. And then I'm going to start on the lecture notes for today. Discovery 1 is an introduction course to networking, home networking, and we will be talking about small integrated services routers, which are little routers that have got ADSL modems and things in them, but we'll cover that in a later chapter. We'll be talking about what sort of components networks are made up of. We are going to be talking about how you set up small home office networks, and we will be talking about how the internet and stuff works from a simplistic level. I will be giving a lecture on binary at some point in Discovery 1. It's not critical to you passing Discovery. However, if you want to go on to Discovery 2, you'd better know your binary, and if we cover a little bit of it now, it gives everybody a chance to freak out about it initially, and then they find it a lot easier to do that when they are doing Discovery 2. And I'm just going to close Twitter down because you guys can probably hear my new tweet notification through... Oh, good. Well, anyway, I can, so I'll just close Twitter down. All right, we're going to get started, I think. Okay, first thing we're going to talk about, and this is basically, this module, and we apologize in advance, is basically an overview of computer stuff. What sort of computers we've got and all that sort of goodness. Where computers are used. I could spend 10 minutes waiting for everybody to tell me different things, but we'd say that computers are used in homes, they're used in offices, they're used in businesses, they're used in multinational enterprises, there are embedded computers in washing machines, some fridges have got computers, there are computers used in all sorts of different places. Your mobile phone has a computer in it, your PDA, if you have one, has a computer in it. All those sorts of things. I don't think we need to really cover too much about that, except to say that there are basically two sort of use segments of the computer. You've got your sort of home use and that sort of stuff segment, and then you've got your industrial uses for computers, such as in companies and that sort of thing. And we'll talk about the differences between those in a moment. Okay, can anybody tell me what hardware is? These lectures are interactive, anyone?
It's basically anything you can touch.
Anything you can touch? Yeah, although I can pick up my Windows 7 CD. Can you be a bit more specific?
Motherboard, memory, hard drives, floppy drives, CD-ROMs, video cards, sound card.
Yeah, the stuff. Yep, the stuff that makes up your computer. The actual components that as the student that I wasn't sure who that is yet. And I think for the first... no, I know that's Glenn that's just talking there, and I think just for the first lecture or so, can we have people, and we'll let you off this time, Glenn, just say your name before you say what you're saying so that we can all get used to your voices, because there's a lot of you. They are the bits and pieces you can touch in your computer, such as the as Glenn pointed out, RAM, hard drives, CPUs, cases, motherboards, printers, scanners, webcams, sound cards, yada yada yada. Okay, can anybody else tell me what software is? Bless you to the person who sneezed in the room here.
Yeah, this is Gary. Software is instructions that tell the hardware what to do.
I'll take that as a pretty good definition. Okay, you get a virtual cyber lollipop. Okay, all right, just to be a real pain, can anybody tell me what firmware is? And this is not in your test, so if nobody knows, that's okay.
Glenn, it's a method of updating hardware using a software basis.
Kind of.
This is Drew. This is hopefully I'm audible. Oh, good. Yeah, firmware is a set of low-level instructions that tell hardware devices how to operate.
Yeah, it's basically the sandwich layer between the sandwich layer between the. Oh, somebody's looping me back on the channel here. Is it? Yep, stop now. Whoever is looping me back onto channel, you may have your record source set incorrectly. You need it set to your microphone, not to the what you can hear setting. I don't know whether that's a problem, I'm just guessing. Okay, and how about an operating system? Can anybody tell me what an operating system does? And by the way, just before we argue about who's going to talk, I'm being looped back again. So whoever just keyed up, it's you.
Hello, this is Kevin Chow. What operating system is pretty much the core component that what makes you run your computer and allows you to install additional applications onto your computer, such as Windows 7, Vista, and XP are operating systems. Leopard and Snow Leopard on the Mac side are operating systems.
Yeah, we'll take that as a definition of operating system. It is the stuff that allows you to deal with all of your files and your documents and use your computer, and it talks to your video card and prints pictures on the screen or scrolls text or whatever you happen to be doing with your operating system. A computer without an operating system isn't particularly useful unless you're the sort of person who has fun playing in the BIOS for hours on end. I'm not one of those, and I don't think anybody here is one of those. We've also got operating systems such as Linux, which bears a mention because it's quite a popular one. Amiga OS, if you've still got one of those things lying around. Also things like Symbian is an operating system for mobile phones. So they're all different sorts of names of operating systems. I should probably mention Android because it seems to be the flavour of the month. And there is OS X, of course, for the iPhone. Okay, I think we've covered the big ones. Anybody else can go and do their operating system separately, but you've got different ones for mainframes and stuff, which we won't cover at this particular point in time.
Like, actually, I have some friends that actually prefer using Unix. I'm not quite sure why.
I am. I use Unix. Linux. I like it. It's very stable, reliable, and it's free. Linux is anyway. Yeah, we like it. Anybody who wants to run their file server under Windows had better know about data recovery and fault tolerance. You should probably know about those if you run it under Linux as well. But it is also highly accessible from a blind person's perspective because it has a text-based interface. And if you are lucky/unlucky enough to be studying CS110 with us next semester, you'll get your hands dirty in Linux. And you might either learn to love it or hate it.
Which flavor of Linux?
Not talking about it today, it's not relevant. We'll come back to that another time. I have the misfortune of having to manage some OS X systems, and if you want to tear your hair out, you can go do OS X Server. But my home Linux is Ubuntu. But I do not have a GUI installed, so let's move on. Don't forget, if you want to answer a question, it's your name into the chat window. And someone's looping me back, Am I still being looped back? Yes, I am. Jonathan! Jonathan!
You're looping audio.
Back on the channel. Please set your record
set.
Source even. I have trouble hearing myself
To the microphone rather than the
what you can hear. Thank you. Okay. Now... Sorry, did somebody want to say something there? I can hear probably Kevin miking up occasionally. If that is you miking up, Kevin, please change your hotkey from left control, because it's opening every time you silence speech. No, you're still looping audio back. Jonathan, I'm afraid. You'll have to go into your record mixer and set your input to be the microphone. Okay. Is everybody else hearing the loopback?
I am.
This is Rich. I'm hearing it.
Yep. I am as well.
Okay. Can you disconnect? Jonathan and Grace will help you on Skype. Okay. All right. We need to talk about. Give me a sec. Right. Problem partially solved. Okay. This should make your life somewhat simpler. Guys, is that better?
Yeah.
That's a lot better.
It's much better.
Yeah, jolly good. Grace is going to go and help him in the common room. Okay, two different sorts of software. We're talking about industrial software, which tends to be used in industrial places like CAD and computer-aided things like virtual reality and stuff, and you're talking about all the really heavy iron stuff that runs in businesses, such as on mainframe computers, databases, transaction processing, all of that sort of stuff. And then you've got general use software, which is the stuff that general people use at home. So, for example, office suites, for example, Microsoft Office, Open Office, there are other ones, I'm sure. There's like Nicis Writer Pro and all sorts of things you can get if you're talking Mac. Star Office. Well, Star Office was taken over by... Oh, no, Star Office is the paid version of Open Office, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Does anybody know how the acquisition of Sun by... somebody bought them, is going to affect
Oracle.
Oracle, yes. Yes. I wonder if that's the end of Star Office, Open Office.
Could be the end of Orca.
Yeah, I saw that.
SQL.
Apparently MySQL's being left relatively unchanged from what I hear. But yeah, Orca's possibly going to be shot. Okay, graphics tools such as Photoshop, I don't know, Microsoft Paint, does that rate as a graphics tool? I suppose it does. Let me see, graphics tools, the GIMP. Not very accessible to screen reader users, but quite useful if you are doing graphics and you don't want to pay for Photoshop and you are not interested in being done for software piracy. Highly recommended. So if somebody wants a very capable piece of software, they can either sell their soul to Google and use Picasa, which is a very good photo organization software, or you can download the GIMP for Windows, which is free. Don't pull the version off QCAT.org. It's hideously out of date. You have been warned. Any questions so far? Okay. Difference between local application. Jonathan's looping me back again. Sort of tempting to say things like, I'm an idiot.
And see if it says you're an
and
idiot.
See if
back,
it says you're an idiot
so,
back, but it doesn't. So, okay. Let's have a look here. Oh no. Problem is resolved. Okay, for the moment. Okay, local applications run on the computer themselves. Network applications run over the internet, such as the internet or a local area network. Can anybody give me an example of a local application? You can either type your answer into chat, or you can type your name into chat and we'll let you talk. Am I transmitting, guys?
Yes.
Apparently I wasn't for a bit there, according to Grace, but maybe she was having problems. Did everybody hear my thing about the difference between a local application and a network application, or did we miss that bit?
Should did carry.
We heard it.
Oh, jolly good. Okay, it's just Grace. That's okay. She's my partner. She's expected not to listen to me on the odd occasion. Okay. I'll get hit for that later. Anybody give me an example of a local application? Either type it into chat or... Paul!
Local application would be one that's loaded onto your machine. And a network would be one that runs off a server somewhere else other than your machine.
That's right. Quick, could you give me an example of a local application, something that would run on your computer? And Scott Erickson's already said Microsoft Word.
Quicken. Outlook.
Yeah, fair enough. Well done. Okay, and obviously you can do network installs of Microsoft Word, but that's not the point. There are still bits of it that live on your local workstation, so we could argue that it is a local application. Now, I don't know if everybody's been seeing in the media that they're pushing towards... pushing towards cloud computing, which is where we run all our applications off on hosted computers and run virtualization in a computing cloud, and we run all our computers off-site. Basically, it's a move back towards the mainframe way of doing things and not actually having the computing power on your desktop, and they're pushing that for various scalability and reliability reasons.
But the desktops are so powerful these days, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, for some companies it makes sense. I mean, if you can... I know, for example, at the association here we have a Citrix WinFrame server. Yes, the guy who was running IT about 6 years ago thought it would be a good idea. And all of the telemarketers have 486s on their desks running a WinFrame client, talking to the WinFrame server, and the theory was that it was supposed to reduce total cost of ownership. We didn't generally find that that was the case, but hey, these things happen. Okay, now with network applications, you've got two parts to the application. For example, you've got the part that runs on your local workstation, and you've got the part that runs on the server, and the example they're giving in the notes here is email. So for example, you've got your email thing that runs on your workstation, but you've also got the server that holds your email or whatever, whether that be POP or IMAP, and we will cover the difference between POP and IMAP in a later lecture. You could also say that the World Wide Web is a network application because your web browser runs on your local computer and the pages that the web browser views are generally hosted on a remote server unless you're doing local web development on your workstation. Anybody got any comments, questions, or anything they want to say before we continue? Grace has an activity for you all to do, apparently.
I do, and we'll just go down the list today in alphabetical order. We are going to talk about which of these applications are network applications and general use applications or business applications. So when you're called on and I read you the questions, I want to know, firstly, is this a network or local application? And secondly, is this a general use consumer software or is this more of a business tool?
Please wait a moment while Grace presses buttons on her braille thing.
The first victim. Okay, Curtis. A student chats with a friend on a computer in another room using instant messaging software.
Someone's mic'd up, but I'm not hearing any audio. Pass it to the next person down, Grace, or come back to Curtis.
Okay. Anyone else want to have a shot at it? That's right.
This is Paul. This is Paul. That would be a network application.
Absolutely, and that is consumer general use software.
And Drew did type his name in the chat. We must have missed him in the chat. We must have missed him.
Well, he gets the next one. All right. Drew, a family keeps track of their financing using a spreadsheet on a computer's hard drive.
Local use or
local
network? I'm being looped back again. It is local.
Jonathan, I'm going to mute you globally,
and we're going to have to resolve this at some point. Okay, problem solved. That solved it, guys?
Sounding good, Harry. No loop.
Okay, if you've got anything you want to say to us, Jonathan, you're going to have to type it into the chat, mate, because I've globally muted you. We will try and sort you out after lecture, but you are looping audio back onto the channel, and everybody else is hearing a double, and you'll hear what we mean when you listen to the recording, so nothing personally. So that's why she's...
Just give me a call over Skype, and I'll help you out with it.
Pretty much. That's why he's got a G next to his name, if anybody wants to know. It stands for globally muted, and I'll turn that off after lecture.
Okay, so is that a consumer use or business application?
Well, it seems to be more of a business use, but I suppose that, you know, regular consumers use it all the time as well, so.
Yes, this is in a family setting, so actually it would be a consumer okay. In this particular case. All right, Gary Jackson, you're next. A construction company develops a program to estimate the cost of building a new home, which is loaded from a CD.
It's a business application. This is Gary, by the way.
Right control, because...
It is a... So what did you say it was? I missed the answer to that.
I said business application.
It is.
Right. And is that local or network?
I'm sorry, is that still to me or somebody else?
That's still to you.
Network.
No.
No, that would be local. It's loaded off a CD, actually. So it's going to reside on the hard drive.
So the key to answering these questions is to figuring out the two parts of it. One, is it used in a home or a business setting? And the second part is to figure out whether the application is running across the network or whether it's running on the local workstation. So there's two pieces of information we're trying to figure out. And this discovery stuff is full of this scenario stuff. You know, Ursula is sending an SMS to her friend Bob. It's all the way through this, so unfortunately we're going to have to get used to this scenario-based learning, which some people like.
And you get a lot of it in the quizzes, so that's why we're practicing here. All right, it's Gary Galbert's turn. A real estate agent uses a computer to post information about a house listing that allows other real estate agents to access it from their computer.
That is a business application, and it is network.
Absolutely right. All right, Glenn, a person sends an email to a friend in another country.
I guess that could be used both for personally and for business, the access of using the internet, I suppose it's going to be networked somewhere along the line.
We go for personal because it's somebody sending a friend a message rather than a business use. And unfortunately, some of these discovery questions split hairs like this. They want you to pick out whether it's a business or whether it's a friend, and you've basically got to look at what words they use and figure out which one they're referring to. It's all pretty silly, but hey, I don't set the exams.
Okay, and I think we get the idea, so we will finish up with that for now.
Okay, now we're talking about types of computers. We're talking about mainframes, servers, desktops, workstations, laptops, and handheld portable devices. So I'll just go back to the top of my list and briefly run over those. Well, not literally run over them, although they'd be very flat. Okay, mainframes tend to be big computers that are used in, generally speaking, businesses, banks, those sorts of things. They tend to handle high volumes of data. They take up a lot more space, generally speaking, than your average sort of servers. And historically, they were accessed by text-based terminals. However, these days, they are now accessed by graphical terminals. And you're looking at companies such as IBM, Data General, there's a few other companies that make mainframes, so quite big computers that do processing for various organizations. Anyone here had anything to do with mainframes?
Yes, I do.
And what do you do with your mainframe, apart from curse and swear at it when it doesn't do what you want it to?
Well, honestly, what we're using is an AS400, which I guess is mid-range. We do some old computer-aided dispatching and basically records keeping.
Yeah, often people have mainframes and stuff, and they've got these, well, not all of them, but some of them got these big dot matrix printers and stuff, and sometimes you run this accounting software on them, for example, or, as I say, dispatching or whatever, and all of the paper spews out of the printers, and you pull all the paper off and give it to all the different people and hand it around. Yes, Drew. That was Jerry, I think, that was speaking a minute ago.
Yes, it was Gary Gobert. It looks like Jerry, but it said Gary.
Okay, I'll have an argument with my Jaws dictionary later. It's Gary. Okay.
I was just wondering, no problem. How powerful modern mainframes are, and you know how much more powerful they are than desktops or servers or other workstation type computers.
It's sort of a line that's sort of been blurred, really. It really depends on how you measure. I mean, there are certainly desktops that are more powerful than older mainframes. For example, the PDP-11 isn't very powerful by today's standards, but generally speaking, mainframes are characterized by the fact that they use lots of terminals. They tend to do transaction-based stuff, so you put in a request or whatever and the request is acted on. So it's not really the same sort of interaction as you'd get with a desktop. So that's sort of the classical difference. But yeah, some of the mainframes can be very powerful. Some of the bigger IBM boxes and stuff. A lot of banks use mainframe technology to handle all of their transaction processing and stuff. And the ATMs, which are basically PCs in a little box. One of my friends always wanted to know what would happen. Could you actually reboot the thing by pressing withdraw, deposit, and enter at the same time? It turns out you can't. But we actually have seen some ATMs when they crash. They're 386s booting up Windows NT4. So there you go.
I'm going to tell you to say cheerio. It's almost like...
Bye, Leon.
Cheerio, all. Sorry, Gary.
Just go, Leon, please. Just if that's cool. I mean, we know you've got to go for lunch, and that rather than interrupting lecture, we'll assume you've got to go if you leave around this time. Okay. Who was saying something, Grace? Oh, jolly good. Now, servers. Yeah, somebody want to say something? Okay. Yeah, just for reference on the recording, we can tell when users enter and leave. I have my text-to-speech turned on, so if you leave the server or you join the server, I do pay attention to who's left and who's gone. Sometimes we muck it up, but usually we tend to know who's on here and who's not, so it's all good.
I was just mentioning that we've I went to go get a ticket for a train, an electronic thing, and I guess it had crashed or something, and it was running XP. We couldn't do anything with it, because it just had an XP desktop on there. We couldn't access it at all.
Yeah, it happens. We had the computers at Centrelink that crashed, and somebody was just about to do a job search, and all of a sudden it said blue screen at blah, 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 and we could see it, you know, performing memory dump. And we're like, well, nobody's job searching on that terminal right now. Okay, servers are programs that generally provide, are computers that generally provide resources to clients, and clients are computers or people or whatever that access the resources on a server. So we have things, for example, like file servers, print servers, web servers. So file servers let you get files off a server. For example, some people have Windows Home Group, which is kind of a servery sort of hybrid thing. Some people actually do have servers in their house, like we do. We have a couple of servers. And they let us store files and stuff, and they also let us share printers. Can anybody tell me why sharing one printer among multiple users might be a good idea? And handy hint, this comes up as a question in ITE1. So if you remember the answer to this, you'll get one right in the ITE1 quiz.
This is Kevin Chow. A good reason to share a printer among multiple computers is so you don't have to get up and unplug the printer from one computer and transfer it to a different computer just to print it off of that one computer. So you just keep it in one central location, print it from anywhere and everywhere as long as you're on that specific network.
That's true. The other reason to share printers is, has anybody ever seen what happens when you have 30 inkjet printers with 30 cartridges and 30 secretaries changing 30 cartridges? It's not a fun situation, let me tell you.
It also can be quite expensive. Our local sheriff's office where I work spends about $40,000 a year just on printer cartridges.
Yeah, in fact, the printer manufacturers actually rub their hands together when it comes to inkjet, and they say, liquid gold, because it's certainly a cash cow for them. Now, we cover this more in ITE1, but don't go putting cheap ink in your printers. There was a really good ad from Epson, actually, that was talking about putting cheap inks in printers, and they had a washing machine, and somebody had put concrete in the washing machine. And that was the ad campaign for not putting cheap ink in your printer. I'm not going to go into why you don't put cheap ink in your printer, but suffice it to say, I have never heard printer technicians swear more than bullock drivers until you mention putting cheap ink into inkjet printers. It does a number on all of the internal components, and you end up paying more to fix the printer or more for a new printer than you would have on your cheap ink or your expensive ink. Okay, desktop computers. We're talking about computers that sit on your desk and that you tend to use, the average sort of computer that a lot of people have in front of them, except, of course, of those of you who either have a laptop or netbook in front of you, you are exempt from having a desktop in front of you. They are called desktops because they tend to sit on the top of the desk. Yes, sounds pretty obvious, but we mention it anyway. Standard personal computer, a huge percentage of them are running a version of Microsoft Windows, and a smaller percentage of you of them, which they believe is getting bigger every day, are running OS X, as in Macintoshes. So they're your two main big desktop computer manufacturers. Okay, workstations are special purpose desktops, basically, that are basically souped up, and they have lots of RAM, possibly, and lots of disk, and they are used for things like virtual reality and computer-aided design and stuff. So they're basically the big brother to the desktop, and they're actually fairly high-spec for the uses that they are put to. They can be. They can be real powerhouses. Now, by the way, is everybody hearing the stuff that's coming up in chat? Has everybody gone into their chat window and ticked the text-to-speech button so they can all hear? Oh, jolly good.
When I check that box.
Really? What are you running?
Crashes. Vista.
Okay, tell Ventrilo to use direct sound for the text-to-speech. It's under the text-to-speech tab. That might stop it from crashing. And we apologize in advance if it doesn't.
Gary, I have a question for you.
Yeah, well, if I disappear...
No worries, we understand. Yes, Gary, who has a question for me.
Yes, where do thin clients fall into? Would that be considered like terminal, or what category does it fall in?
I think we'd say graphic terminal, actually. A graphical terminal. A thin client, for those who don't know, is a low-spec machine that doesn't usually have a lot of RAM or a lot of disk, and then sometimes it doesn't have any disk at all. Sometimes they're network booted, sometimes they do have a little hard disk or some flash storage in them, and they are used for accessing remote resources such as Windows Terminal Server or Citrix WinFrame or MetaFrame. They let you access remote applications on a server.
Sometimes it's very hard to tell the difference between a workstation and a desktop and a server, because sometimes they do overlap and do some of the same things.
Okay, laptops. They're the things that tend to sit on your lap, although generally speaking, not many people sit laptops on their laps. They tend to sit them on their desks, leave them on AC power 24 hours a day, and murder their batteries. Little bugbear of mine. If you do have a laptop, try and cycle your battery every month or so. It does it the world of good. Otherwise, you'll find you don't have any battery life when you need it. There's handheld portable devices, such as PDAs, mobile phones, iPhone, TM. There we go. We've got the TM in there. And those sorts of devices that you tend to carry around and you make and receive phone calls on. Or you do other things on. Yes, Mitchell. Or Mikkel, sorry. I'm going to have to do a number on my JAWS dictionary. It'll happen after lecture.
Mikkel. I have a HP, and it's called a workstation. So why is the laptop called a workstation in that instance?
It's just them blurring the boundaries for you, just to confuse you.
Pretty much, as I said, they do blur the boundaries on these, except really for servers, really do blur just a little bit.
Generally speaking, workstations are called workstations because people are expected to do work at their workstations. So there are sometimes people call the computer on their desk in their office cubicle a workstation because they're supposed to work at it, which means no going on Facebook. Or Twitter. Yes, okay, that's all right. Anybody who hasn't added me onto Facebook, feel free to do so. I do have a, if you feed my email address into Facebook, it will find me.
But and same here. Anyone's welcome to add me.
Not work safer.
I never update.
I do. Anyway.
Is there an accessible app that lets Facebook work with JAWS? Unfortunately, I haven't had the chance to fool with it any.
Oh, that's a discussion for Thursday chat, but a lot of people find that m.facebook.com or the Facebook mobile site works. Also, it's relatively accessible on Symbian mobiles. Also, lite.facebook.com, L-I-T-E. Although I think Scott was saying the other day that all of the order of status updates and stuff is now all screwed up on the mobile site. Is that correct?
Yeah, you tend to get, sometimes you'll get status updates that were sent, 6 or 17 hours ago and stuff, and then randomly you'll just get one that was sent 4 minutes ago. Doesn't always happen, but the new Facebook layout is actually interesting. The only issue is you don't always see your status update there. Best to use the mobile site, because the only thing you can't do on the mobile site is play the games and do the Facebook chat.
Oh, well.
Yeah, that's okay. I don't think it's behind the scenes, to be honest, Imran. I think it's always being rewritten, and they make no qualms about that. We busted bits of Facebook. Deal with it. You get what you pay for. Pretty much. If, however, for example, you're interested in going on Facebook, if you're playing Farmville, I don't want to hear about it. If you're playing Mafia Wars, I don't want to hear about it. And you'll get instantly blocked if you send me too many status updates about how you just got a cow in Farmville.
Ugly duckling. Go ahead,
Stacey.
No audio, Stacey. Oh, there you go.
I could have heard you all the time. It's just Grace was delayed. Sorry, you're talking about the PDAs or something, the icon for a PDA, perhaps? Was that what you're asking about? It certainly is. The icon is unfortunately a black box. And basically you get what's on it, and you can't do that much customization to it, but it is a kind of nice device, and I've spoken to a lot of icon users who love their icon, although I think that its support for things like the web technologies like Facebook and stuff, I'm not sure how good it would be at doing that, but yes, that would classify as a mobile device. So would a Braille note, so would a...
Trekker Maestro,
Braille Sense.
Even the Braille Speak.
Even the Braille and Speak would classify. And if we haven't mentioned your product, it's nothing personal. There's lots of other ones out there that we would mention as well. But hey, but yeah, so. Okay, well, some people think the icon is way too slow, and Rich wanted to say something, followed by Drew.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I have the Braille Plus, which is the version of the icon, and I use it for quite a bit, and it does have a Twitter feature, which I really haven't used Twitter too often, but it does have a Twitter feature on it.
Somebody probably just put a wrapper around Twidge. How does it go with things like sites that contain JavaScript and stuff, or is it not? That's not really its market?
It's okay once you get a chance. Once you get used to the navigation commands, I've done quite a few things. I've shopped online with it. I've done plenty of reading with it. I find it very accessible, actually.
Okay, well, it's all what you're used to, I suppose. It doesn't like the National Bank site, it's gone.
No, it doesn't. I've got one here, and it definitely doesn't like it. You can't, like, always combo boxes it doesn't like, but it's all full of JavaScript and strange stuff, and yeah.
Drew wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you can use the icon as a terminal as well, because it's got the Linux command line and whatnot.
Yeah, you can. I haven't actually seen how much of it's an open and closed box as to how much you can actually customize on it. But yeah, it basically runs a Linux distribution with a modified speak up and a whole lot of utilities that they've dropped on there. So anyway, let's get back to our lecture notes though, unfortunately. Okay, servers generally have lots of RAM. When we're talking lots of RAM, we're talking multiple gigabytes of it. So 4 gigs, 8 gigs, 16 gigs, pile in the RAM, lots of disks. Obviously, if you ask somebody in 10 years' time what's multiple, what is a lot of RAM, I can see myself in 60 years in the old people home sort of saying, I remember when we used to have 4 gig of RAM, and they'll all look at me and go, yeah, well, we've got terabytes in our machine now, so, I mean, times change. Moore's law, obviously, being that RAM and disk space tends to double every 18 months or so. Disks, lots of disks, often redundant disks, for example, RAID, redundant array of inexpensive disk drives. I suppose inexpensive is relative. Sometimes multipath disk arrays, which is where you have multiple paths to the same I.O. subsystem. So lots of RAM, lots of disk, and redundant components, such as multiple power supplies. Also some backup power supplies, such as uninterruptible power supplies or standby power supplies. The difference between an uninterruptible power supply and a standby power supply is that a standby power supply has a relay that clicks over when the power drops out, and theoretically that will keep the computers running, whereas an uninterruptible power supply runs its load off the batteries at all times. So the cheap ones are standby power supplies, and the expensive ones are UPSs. We would hope that they have regular backups, and we would also hope that the systems are secured. Common services such as email, file sharing, printer sharing, and all that sort of stuff. That can be desk. Go ahead. Oh, don't then. Somebody was going to make a mic up and say something, but they didn't, so on we go. They can be desktop form factor, they can be rack mount, they can also be blade, which is where you can put all these different sorts of boards into this big sort of thing and get them all working together. It's kind of cool. So they are your servers. Desktops are in many configurations, and here's where I become a real pain, and I say refer to the ITE1 lecture for information. Okay, so if you're not in ITE1, I'd recommend you download ITE1 Module 1, but we are going to talk about all the different case form factors such as ATX, ITX, Mini ITX, BTX, Full Towers, Mini Towers, all those sorts of things.
And we'll probably go through them in somewhat painful detail.
Laptops are portable. That's something I wrote in my notes. That was obviously very important. I don't know about that. Does anybody remember when we used to have the luggables and they were about, they must have weighed about 20 pounds and they were about, 3 foot long and they had a handle on one end? I had one that was sort of this Amstrad thing and it had like a full-size keyboard and two 3.5-inch 720K floppy drives. And, it was great. We called it Log. Just because that's what it sort of looked like.
This is Gary. I had one that was called a lunchbox.
I had the Commodore 64 with a built-in screen and the SX, but yeah, there's a lunchbox. Okay, so they're luggable. Now, just out of morbid curiosity, how many people here have netbooks?
Oh yeah, love the netbook.
I've got multiple netbooks.
I know, I bought some off you. Anyone else got a netbook? Does anybody not know what a netbook is?
We did a really awesome chat on networks, on netbooks. So if you're interested in knowing a little bit about netbooks, check out that Thursday chat. It's very, very good, and it talks about some of the ones we have.
I think that was Blindy Grab Bag 1, wasn't it? And Blindy Grab Bag 2, did we talk about netbook? No, there was a netbook chat, and then
there was a netbook chat,
yeah, last year.
Yeah, there was, because you were on there. Scott, I remember that. Okay, so if you want to know about netbooks, get the netbook chats, because we actually go through and we tell you about which ones are good and which ones are not and which problems you have with the mini notes and what problems you have with the EEPCs and what goes on with the wins and who's got good wireless and who's got bad wireless, and it's pretty cool. We're pretty cool.
And also, Kerry went through the entire history of netbooks.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, I remember that.
You can tell I've got no life. Okay, so guys, in all seriousness, if you're interested in learning things that are outside the course, there is a folder up on the www.qcat.org website off the student resources page called Thursday Chats. And boy, oh boy, is there some stuff in there. We tell you how to find out how to do temperature conversions on Google. We talk about computer forensics. We talk about the deployment of IPv6. We do chats on netbooks. We do... the blindy grab bag chats are all different sorts of things about
Linux.
All different, yeah, Linux chats and stuff. Yeah, and we do Ed. We do the Linux editor Ed. And I don't care if I get sued for the following remark. It's a bit like Blind Cool Tech, but there's a bit of quality assurance in there.
And there's also some really good stuff on like computer forensics or something. You're all in Discovery One. You're all doing the scavenger hunt, which means you'll get to go into that Thursday chat folder and pick out one that you might like to listen to sometime.
And just to cover my backside, I'd like to say that there are some podcasts on Blind Cool Tech that I do enjoy a lot, but most of them I don't, because there isn't really a lot of quality control there. So, yeah, there you have it. So that's our version of Blindy Cool Tech, and we also tend to get to the point very, very quickly with our Thursday chats, which unfortunately doesn't always happen on Blind Cool Tech. And if you haven't been to Blind Cool Tech, go and check that out too, which is www.blindcooltech.com. Lots and lots of information on there about all different sorts of things. And it's a goldmine of information. I go there and grab stuff as well. Can anybody tell me what the difference between a laptop and a netbook is? Yes, Stacey. That's very true. And we can tell you that if you want to know anything about netbooks, we'll cover you in a second, Drew. That's true. Netbooks don't have a CD or DVD drive, generally speaking. They are smaller. They generally weigh under 4 pounds. Generally under 2 pounds, actually. You can get 2 pound ones, or sort of 2.5, 3 pounds. So they're very light. They tend to have a slightly slower processor, although the screen size is under 10 inches. So we are talking screen size here. Although there is a Lenovo that still classes itself as a netbook that has a 10.2-inch screen. So I actually think the cutoff is 12. Is 11 or 12 inches. That was actually due to a Microsoft licensing restriction, which I talk about on the netbook chat. Seriously, if anybody wants any information on netbooks, talk to myself or Scott Erickson or Grace. I own 6 or 7 netbooks, and Grace owns 2? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got 2.
So we know a bit about netbooks. Yes, Drew.
Yeah, there we go. Netbooks usually have longer battery life as well, and no CD drive. And most of them don't have a hard drive, although several do. But for the most part, I think it's usually flash drive.
A lot of them have hard drives, and if you're torrenting, can you stop, please, or limit the up speed?
It's not that. I have no idea what it is. It's my audio interface is giving me fits, so I pass.
Fair enough. Yes, Gary.
Yes, is the connection with a netbook primarily used a wireless card as opposed to like a built-in 10100 or anything like that?
Some of them have do. Some of them do have. Most of them have onboard networking. They have 10100. In fact, the HP Mini Notes have gigabit networking on them. And you can use wireless as well. A lot of them have N wireless. A lot of them have G. A lot of them have. And most, I think, just about all the netbooks have wireless in them. Yes, Mikkel.
I'm just curious. Is there a reason that you have six of them? Is there some type of advantage to it?
Well, I'm a technology freak, you know. Some people have lots of cars. Some people have lots of women. I have lots of netbooks.
I want to know how many computers are in our house.
Yeah, pretty much. I bought netbooks for all different reasons, and I use them for different things. One of my netbooks sits in the clothes basket on the dining room table and runs our torrents. It chews 20 watts of power. It's very environmentally friendly. And it just torrents 24 hours a day. It's great.
One of them is just only for running our surround sound system.
Yeah, there's one in the bedroom that we play our graphic audio dramas on, and it connects into our surround sound system, and we listen to our music on it. Basically, when you work and you've got money, you decide what you spend it on, and, well, I don't really like cars, they're a bit greasy, and I can't drive them, so computers and netbooks it is. Also, if one breaks, I've got five others, which is possibly a bit excessive, but that's why I tend to have multiples of things, because there's nothing worse than when your primary piece of technology falls over and you're disadvantaged. Okay, next we talk about pocket PCs, which are those little ones that are supposed to fit in your pocket. They're getting better. We just bought five licenses for Mobile Speak 4 from JJ, ironically enough, who's studying with us this year. He runs blindbargains.com, he also runs The Zone, and he's a generally all-around good guy. For www.atguys.com, that's as much advertising as you're going to get this semester, but there you go. And that runs on Thanks. Pocket PCs. That's alright. Well, we're supposed to be non-commercial, you see, so I can't be too blatant.
It's all good.
But for your assistive technology needs, log on to www.atguys.com. Okay, there we go. And they also have PDAs, which are personal digital assistants. And they are similar to pocket PCs. I'm not sure what the specific difference between them is. Maybe you define a BlackBerry as a personal digital assistant? And we talk about cell phones, we talk about gaming devices, and we talk about... we're not going to talk about mobile phones. I think we all know what they are. Yes, Curtis. I hear a fuzzy noise, but I don't hear Curtis. Check a mute switch or a microphone plug, perhaps? We'll come back to you, but we haven't forgotten about you, but if you resolve that, we'll certainly hear from you in a second. Laptops tend to run off batteries, they're portable, and they use less power, which makes Al Gore happy. It's kind of a blurry line, to be honest. I mean, smartphones, if you're saying smartphone as far as Windows mobile smartphone, that's a particular operating system, but generally a smartphone is a phone that has features in it such as word processing and spreadsheets and stuff, but generally it's primarily a phone, whereas a PDA is generally a pocket PC that has phone functionality bolted on. So it just depends on which one you see as being the more important thing as to whether it's called a smartphone. And a lot of the PDAs didn't used to have phones. And then when they started bundling phones onto PDAs, they started sort of putting this little extra application that was the phone application. And on some of the really bad ones, as soon as you went to make or receive a phone call, it would crash your PDA. Yes, I have an iMate Jazz Jar, and it does that from time to time. But then they sort of got better, so it's all good. And if you're a blind person who wants to look at PDAs and mobile smartphones, you've obviously already heard the website that you can go and look at for bits of information on that. Otherwise, you can certainly look at iPhones. There we go, Apple people. iPhone. Or you can look at Windows PDAs, and you can buy Mobile Speak Pocket, or Mobile Speak as it's now called, or Pocket Howl, or various other options. And if you're one of... That's actually something we can work on with you at some other point. That's actually probably due to the screensaver you're running or some other piece of software that just has a memory leak on it, but we won't talk about that at the moment. Oh, okay.
It used to.
Did they shoot it? Ah, right, they ate it.
Okay.
Righto. Okay, well, we'll look for the vaporware in the next 3 to 4 months on that one, and if something comes out, we'll... Oh, yeah, okay, hang on, three people now care about a ratio.
Yeah, three, that's good.
There's a program called a ratio that apparently makes one model of BlackBerry somewhat accessible. Okay, there we go. Let's move on.
I have a Thursday chat on how good it is.
That won't be a long one.
Are you running that one, Scott?
Yeah, okay. It'll only take 5 minutes.
Okay, seriously, there are probably people who do need a BlackBerry for some reason because of Outlook and email sync and stuff, even though the iPhone now apparently does that not too badly. There are still people who do want a BlackBerry. I refuse to have that sort of device because I personally don't want to be that available. There are times when I'd like to be offline, so don't put a BlackBerry anywhere near me. Okay, now we get to discuss. Okay, any questions before we continue? I suppose people are probably finding these pretty full-on lectures, and for that we apologise. That's why we've got recordings, so that if your brain goes all splotty in the middle, you can do it in stages from the recordings. We do have a lot to cover, as you probably guessed, and we do tend to fill up our time slot pretty well. Anybody got any questions before we continue? Okay, now we're going to discuss bits and bytes very briefly, and units of storage. And I think there's a worksheet on this in Discovery 1, isn't there?
Yep. Yeah, we've at least got a question on it in the quiz that we'll get to.
Okay, a bit is the smallest piece of information that a computer can generally use. It's generally a 1 or a 0, and it refers to the state of a circuit, either on or off. We're not talking about tri-state logic here. Bytes is 8 bits, generally speaking. Yes, I know there are different numbers of bytes that have different numbers of bits, but as far as we are concerned, a byte has 8 bits for our course. Generally, you will find that characters such as ABC, Q7, and the funny little squiggly thing that Jaws says is tilde are represented as part of the ASCII character set, or the American Standard Code for Information Interchange. Sadly, we now have people who live in other countries than America, and ASCII doesn't really cut it, which is why we have Unicode, which lets you represent foreign characters and things in Unicode in a lot of different ways. There's like 8-bit Unicode and 16-bit Unicode and Unicode that should really be... Anyway, it's a mess. Now, UTF-8 is an 8-bit version of International Character Set, I think. You actually map the type of international code you've got into an 8-bit table. So you have a Latin 1 table for Europe and a Latin 3 table for somewhere else. Hey, Wikipedia works well, guys. How about somebody come back to me next week and tell me what UTF-8 is? That's what I'd be doing anyway, but I think that's essentially how it works. Basically, a lot of programs got very upset when we started representing characters in multi-byte form, so they had to come up with an encoding that would use 1 byte per character, and they wanted to get all sorts of international stuff into it, so I think you actually map a code page onto the top of the 8-bit mapping. Okay. Units of storage. Can anybody give me an example of a unit of storage apart from bit and byte, which I've already talked about?
This is Gary. Would a megabyte be one, or is that still considered byte?
No, megabyte, we'll give you that. Gigabyte, yeah. Yeah, gigabyte. Yeah, terabyte. Okay. Now, a petabyte, yes. Big one. Okay. Now, there are two different sorts, and I'll cover this briefly because this is very important. When we do binary, we use 2 to the power of stuff, okay? 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. I could even sing the inchworm song for you, but I won't, okay? They're powers of 2. 2 to the power of 0 is 1. 2 to the power of 1 is 2. 2 to the power of 2 is 4. 2 to the power of 3 is 8. I'm not going to go through binary today, but suffice it to say that they're your 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32 sort of stuff. If you are looking, there are two different sorts of kilobytes, and there are two different sorts of megabytes and things, okay? Technically, they are given different names, but we will talk about both of them. When we are measuring memory, we usually measure memory in the binary version of kilobytes. Can anybody tell me how many bytes are in a binary kilobyte?
1,024.
Yes, and for an extra cyber lollipop, 2 to the power of what? Any idea? It's okay if you don't.
No idea.
That's alright. 2 to the power of 10, I believe. And a megabyte is 2 to the power of 20, if you're talking binary kilobytes and megabytes. They're also called kibibytes and mibibytes, K-I-B-I, or M-I-B-I, okay? They are used in measuring of RAM. Now, drive manufacturers, because they want to measure their disk space and they want to rip you off, they measure a kilobyte as 1,000 bytes, and they measure a gigabyte as, what did I just say? A megabyte as a million bytes, and a gigabyte as 1 billion bytes. So when you get a 320 gigabyte hard drive, it is 320 billion and a bit bytes, but it's actually 320 billion, not 320 binary gigabytes, which is why Windows shows you that you've got less gigabytes on your 320 gig drive than 320. Anyone ever wondered about that?
It's Glenn here. Is that the difference between measuring in decimal as opposed to binary numbers?
No. It's just that rather than seeing a kilobyte as 2 to the power of 10, we see it as 1,000 if we're doing it in the regular ones. And, I didn't get a lot of sleep last night either, but it's all cool. I'll be hitting the coffee after this lecture, I can tell you. So it's not the difference between binary and decimal, it's just that there are two different measurements. One is the binary measurements, and one is the normal measurements, so we use 1,000, million, billion. Someone's keyed up, and I can hear television in the background.
Yeah, looks like Melanie.
Ah. Okay, no problem. At least she's not looping my audio back, so we might just deal. I think it might be Melanie who's keyed up. Okay, any questions about units of storage so far? Yeah, it is you that's keyed up, Melanie. You have an open mic, so don't say nasty things. Ah, there you go, you're fixed now. Just don't say nasty things about me when you've got an open mic. Welcome. Oh, no, Leon hasn't joined the server yet. Okay, any questions about Unix or storage so far? And welcome back, Leon. Okay, now, the other thing to keep in mind is when we are talking data communications, we tend to measure our data communications in the thousands, millions, billions, okay? So when you get a 2 megabit connection, it is a 2 million bits per second connection, not a 2 mibibit connection, okay? And the other thing to keep in mind is if we write capital M lowercase b slash s, we mean megabits, and if we write capital M capital B slash S, that's megabytes. So big B is for byte, because obviously the big B bites you. I would think the big B would sting you, but there you go. So capital B means megabytes per second, little b means megabits per second, and yes, it is important. Okie dokie. Andrew will be back presently. So when you sign up for your ADSL connection, and you get a 1.5/256k connection, you will end up with 1,000. You'll end up with 1,500,000 bits per second down, and you'll end up with 256,000 bits up. So that's why the speeds are slightly different. Now, the other thing we're going to talk about very briefly, and because it's in your worksheet, and I think I need to talk about it now, which is a bit tedious, but here we go. There is a little bit of math in discovery. Okay, I apologize for that in advance. If we are trying to do some calculations, and I will go over this again at some point if people have trouble with it next week, because we will need to go over it a couple of times. Is everybody familiar with the process of how to calculate how long it is going to take to transfer a given amount of data over a different speed connection? And it's okay if you say no. Good. At least we're honest. That's no worries. Well, that's what we're here for. We're all here to learn. Okay. Now, if we are, and I'm pretty sure there is a worksheet that makes
not
you do. Not in this chapter.
No, it's like five.
Oh, okay. Well, we don't have to do it today. So what I'll do is I'll very quickly cover it, and I'm going to come back to it, guys. So I'm just going to mention this briefly. Everybody knows when you measure a car, when you're driving along in a car, you measure your speed in. Well, if you're in America, you measure it in miles per hour. And if you're in Australia, you measure it in kilometres per hour. Okay? So if you're going at 60 kilometres per hour and you drive for 1 hour, how far did you go? Or 60 miles an hour and you've driven for an hour, how far did you go? You have gone 60 miles or 60 kilometres. We'll just go miles for the moment, okay? So if you are going at, if you're going at 60 miles an hour and you drive for half an hour, how far have you gone?
30 miles.
That's right. Okay, just to be really tedious, last one, if you're driving at 60 miles an hour and you drive for 2 hours, how far have you gone?
120 miles.
Yay! Okay. Now, if our link can transfer data at 1 million bits per second, and we want to transfer 2 million bits, how long is that going to take?
2 seconds.
Hey, well done, guys. You're all doing surprisingly well. So essentially, it's speed divided by time. So the amount equals speed divided by time. And it's an equation that you can flip around and you can work out how long it would take to download a 20 megabyte file over a 1.5 megabit ADSL connection. We don't do that today. Don't panic. But I've at least given you guys a bit of an inkling that basically a link can only go at a certain speed, and that's what we call digital bandwidth. It's the number of bits we can run through the connection in a given time period. Therefore, the more bits you run through, the longer it is going to take to transfer. Everybody kind of cool with that for the moment? We'll go into more detail in Chapter 5.
You've got quite a bit of time. It's okay if you're not.
Charlie,
and I think that worksheet happens to involve using the Windows calculator as well, so you're pretty safe.
And you can always read ahead, and I bet it's at qcat.org, right?
Yeah, you click on the student resources page. In fact, I'm surprised that half of you don't have a bookmark directly to the student resources page by now. Anybody got a bookmark directly to student resources? I do.
Yes, I do, and I learned very quickly.
No, it's okay. We're not having a shot at anybody. It's just we spent hours on that student resources page to make sure it had as many things on it to make you guys as happy as possible. And to make us as happy as possible, because if you're happy, we're happy. Yeah, you can read ahead if you want to, but and you can even, and for anybody who wants to work ahead, if you find these lectures all a bit tedious and boring, I apologise, but you can actually work ahead, and there are lectures from last year which you can play at double speed and they won't be as tedious and boring perhaps. I always find Grace sounds even cuter at chipmunk speed, but that's just personal.
We've got one student that's working ahead at the moment.
I had thought about it, but I have decided that there are things that I can probably pick up just because.
And the lectures, you really can, and you do miss out on the networking if you don't come to lectures and the chance to ask questions in real time.
Hey, everybody enjoying themselves so far, and no, this won't count against your grade if you say no.
I am. I know I would have left if I didn't.
Jolly good. Okay. Now, if we could stop here, or we could continue on for another 10 or 15 minutes. What's everybody think? We have been running for about an hour and a half.
If anyone's tired, it's okay to say, that my brain's fried, I'm done. And that's all.
A bit more is fine.
All right, Paul, if you're fried, you can... Okay, let's just cover one small thing, and then we'll finish up there. I'm talking about a modem. Can anybody tell me what a modem is? Does anybody know what modem stands for?
Modulator, demodulation.
Certainly is. And a modem is a device that... No. What about ADSL modems? I wouldn't call them antique.
Wireless broadband modems. They're pretty nice. I use mine all the time.
Yeah, surf stick. What a modem does is it converts signals from the digital domain into the analog domain. And that means that it converts them from ones and zeros to various patterns of analog energy, such as sound. Or in the case of ADSL, it uses the frequency band between 16 kHz and 30 MHz to shovel your stuff over the phone line. Don't quote me on that. Somebody's going to go on Wikipedia and go, no, it's actually 17.5 kilohertz. I didn't look it up, so I'm not quite sure of the actual frequency bands. You'd have to go and look that up. Yes, even your lecturers make mistakes quite regularly. We try not to. So the modem converts the data from a digital to an analog form, and it converts from an analog form to a digital. So modulator means it converts to analog, demodulator means it converts it back to digital. And you have modems all the way from dial-up modems to ADSL modems, cable modems. Cable modems use television signals on the same band as the television frequency to shovel your data over your internet connection.
Yeah, this is Gary. I just wanted to mention, with our old AS400 that we're still using, we have some 9600 baud modems.
Okay.
They're still around.
That's impressive.
Alrighty. Look, I'll tell you what, guys. We're going to stop here. Does anybody have any questions before we close the Ventrilo down, before we close the lecture down? Or if anybody wants to ask their question after I've stopped recording, that's okay too. Frequently range of phone lines from an audio perspective is an 8 kHz sampling rate, which results in a Nyquist frequency of 4,000 cycles per second. However, that bandwidth is reduced because they use MULAW encoding, which means that you get more dynamics, but you don't get as much frequency response. I believe the official specs on a phone line say that you should be able to transfer frequencies of up to 3,500 Hz. As far as ADSL is concerned, that really depends on what the copper will carry. And
yes, you do have worksheets to do for next week. I think there's three of them.
Yep.
This is not the end of Chapter 1. This is half of Chapter 1.
You guys get 2 weeks to do this, because we are going to spread it over 2 weeks.
I think we could have gone, you know, we really could have gone hell for leather and got through the whole of Chapter 1 this week, but I don't know how many students would have enjoyed that, so we tend to give you guys a bit of an easier run in the first week, because it always is a bit much getting used to these Ventrilo lectures and stuff first up.
I have an idea for a Thursday chat. I don't know if anybody would be willing to do it, but the quirks of using Ventrilo with Skype at the same time, that caused me issues last week bad.
Just let me stop recording.